Does anyone have any pressing questions that you want to do before I get going? If not, I'll do the caveat that I was going to say is that after talking to people and trying to get a pulse of what people know, I've decided that I'm not going to actually do the path integral derivations or cartoons, but I'll still use them. So we're going to end up using them. But last time I said that we needed these, I'm going to use these three things. I'm going to do one derivation. I'm not going to do this setting up the path integral. We're just going to take that as a given. I will derive the free field version because that's actually part of what we do in effective filters often. And I will use but not derive the Gaussian quadratic action that I wrote there. Okay, but I want to use the language. And so what the language, that's not the Perimeter Institute, but what we did last time was we were looking at the theory of QED, which is defined when you're doing path integral languages as integral over photons and over fermions, d psi, it's in d psi bar. Okay, we can do the e to the I integral d4x, L of QED of a and psi. And the language that we use here is that what we did last time was called integrating out. We integrated out the fermions, and we wrote this as just the integral. Now the only active field at low energies here is the photon. And we have e to the I integral d4x L effective. So an effective Lagrangian that only depends on A, and which we wrote out last time. So that's really what we've done. We've removed it from the theory by integrating it out. And I'll do it using this quadratic action later, straight from path integrals, rather than by doing the matching that I did this time last time. However, we often note that this is only valid over certain regions. And so really what we're saying is that the A field here is limited to the regions where the energy and momentum are small compared to M. So, and this is sort of a little funny thing. This is a limits of the path integral or and so it really is not to be applied beyond certain limits. In this case, we know that limit is roughly the masses. If you get too far above the masses, you should include the fermions directly. In fact, even pure QED, so the top line there, really should have a lambda on it too. So I've gone back and I put that one in. So the lambda, which is circled there in the original one, is not M. It can be done later. But the limit, even pure QED has limits. In fact, we know what those limits are. That lambda is around MW, where the photon doesn't exist anymore. What we are calling the photon becomes part of the third component of the SU2 gauge field, the hypercharged gauge field. The Higgs plays a role because it mixes the two. So the description above that is no longer QED as we know it, but the full standard model. So even pure QED is an effective theory. So we've come to think about all of our theories as potentially effective field theories, but QED in particular is absolutely known to be one. Okay. So this sounds well and good as a philosophy, but one thing I just want to make a comment at this stage is that we say cutoff. Or a limit of the effective field theory. But we don't do that. In practice, we do dimensional regularization. Okay, and one of the things that you see about that is that dimensional regularization doesn't have any scale that limits it. It goes over all energies. So this goes over all energies and is not limited to those below the scale. So it sounds like we have a conflict here, but it's okay. And the reason it's okay is because the high scales are local. And so by Applequist-Carazone, they go into local terms in the Lagrangian. And we identify those by matching or measuring. There are times when dimensional regularization can give you misleading answers because it doesn't know the existence of real limits. So, well, I don't want to go too far into this, but for example, in QCD, the chiral perturbation theory of pions and photons has an effective limit of something like a GeV, because that's where quarks and gluons take over. The kaon mass is half a GeV. If you treat it in dimensional regularization, you get normal results, but you don't know if that's really below or above the cutoff. Twice the kaon mass is a GeV, and so there's some confusion there. But let's not do that stuff now. Okay, so let's wrap up the first part of this, these lectures. We're what I would call EFT 1.0. We've seen the principles, and we know how to categorize these higher order effects. And so effective field theory 1.0 is effective Lagrangians. We can use effective Lagrangians to categorize either new physics or old physics that we know. So it's most commonly done in new physics. And I don't really want to spend much time on this just because I think this part of it, of the subject is sunken into the field's consciousness enough that I don't really have to spend time on it. Let me just do one. If I have a Lagrangian, I can write out a Lagrangian consistent with the symmetries of the standard model. Phi dagger phi is the Higgs. W mu nu are the SU2 gauge bosons. If you do dimensional analysis on that, W squared is like F squared. It is the F squared for the W gauge bosons. Phi dagger phi is dimension 2, so this is some number divided by lambda squared. This would then could be induced by new physics. This measures the deviation in the masses. The rho parameter is mw squared over mz squared cos squared theta. Weinberg in the standard model becomes 1 minus c prime over lambda squared times the vacuum expectation value of the Higgs fields. This turns into v squared. And present bounds on the rho parameter is 1.00039 plus or minus 0.0019. Technically speaking, I'm a little bit, you have to actually tell me more about radiative corrections to get that number, but it is the correct number to compare it to. And so this says that C over lambda squared is roughly 1 over 15 TeV squared. Okay, so you can bound new physics this way. That stuff, I think, is simple enough. I don't really want to spend much time on it. I will do one thing that's interesting, though, and not trivial. So here's a non-trivial thing. Some operators can be removed. So let's imagine that I was doing something. I want to probe new physics. I want to do the mu to E gamma. Okay? Muon decaying to an electron and a photon. I can write out an effective Lagrangian for that. The first one that you might try is mu bar ID slash E plus emission conjugate, where in here D has D mu plus I E A mu. So there's a direct coupling there between photons, muons, and electrons. This would look like it would give you a diagram that looks like that. It does. Another one you could do would be some lambda, just mu bar E, where I could then do things that look like this. Here's that vertex there, and then I radiate a photon later. So an interesting homework exercise for you is to show that these matrix elements vanish on shell. Okay, so if you try calculating with those, and we can explore that if you want in the tutorial at any stage. But the reason is interesting, and that's what I wanted to say. The reason is they can be removed by field redefinitions. Yes?
Could you repeat which matrix elements?
Pardon me?
Which matrix elements?
The matrix element from mu to E gamma. So let's say yes, you're trying to catch it. Yeah. So the idea here is I'm trying to come up with an effective Lagrangian for the decay mu to E gamma. Mm-hmm. And both of these terms that I've written there, in principle, look like to me like they could give mu to E gamma. Mm-hmm. The first one, in fact, gives you a direct coupling from the covariant derivative. The other one looks more like a mass term. Mm-hmm. And So both of these look like they could do it. You could just make a mass insertion, radiate a photon off the final state.
Mm-hmm.
But if you actually calculate both of these, you do all the diagrams that you can think of, and you put them on shell, it vanishes.
So any diagram that will have these kind of vertices vanishes.
It vanishes.
Mean?
Okay. Exactly. Okay. And if you're doing it, it looks like a miracle. Mm-hmm. It only works on shell. Off shell, it doesn't work. But the reason why one can see that it works is if I redefine the fields, you know, E prime is equal to E plus something times mu, and mu prime is equal to mu plus something times E, I can just totally remove these from the Lagrangian. So by field redefinitions like that. And so we'll talk a little bit more about field redefinitions, but certainly in this case here is a good example. So you might try this as homework if you're interested. So that's the caveat. Most of these uses are simple, but you have to be a little bit careful on that feature. Okay. Any questions at this stage? Okay. So now my real topic today is that effective field theory is a full quantum field theory. What we've done so far we've just got these effective Lagrangians out that categorize some more complete theory, but we don't have the effective field theory itself. And so to do this, I'd like to do the nonlinear sigma model. What I'll do is the pathway what we're taking here is I'll first construct it. We can see step by step the construction of the effective field theory. And then the next thing that we do is we will do loops in the effective field theory. So I'll get the effective field theory and we'll do loops and show how quantum effects are calculable reliably in the effective field theory. So that's the non-trivial part of the stuff I want to do next. Okay. So the starting point here is the linear sigma model, which is the basis of the Ginzburg-Landau theories or the Higgs model theory. So I'm actually not going to do that. I'm assuming this is now, but I'll do the notation. Here the Lagrangian I'm going to do involves 1/2 d mu sigma, d mu sigma, plus 1/2 d mu. So now there's going to be four fields. There's going to be three, a vector field, which is called pi, and a scalar field, which is called sigma. And the potential is minus mu squared over 2 sigma squared plus pi squared minus lambda, it's minus is sitting up there, plus lambda over 4 sigma squared plus pi squared squared. Okay. So this is the typical spontaneous symmetry breaking, where this potential looks like that. The minimum is that it can be chosen to be sigma which is v, which is the square root of mu squared over lambda, just looking at the minimum of that potential. And then you expand around that minimum and you get, so the expansion, the first expansion that everyone tends to do, sigma is equal to V plus sigma twiddle. The mass, this gives you a mass of particles. The sigma twiddle, it has mass square root of 2 mu, which is square root of 2 lambda V. So just in terms of these parameters, and the pions are Goldstone bosons. Okay, so that's the part I'm assuming you've seen before. You get Goldstone boson, spontaneous symmetry breaking, etc. If I use this parameterization, V of sigma twiddle pi is lambda V sigma twiddle, twiddle squared plus pi squared plus lambda over 4 sigma twiddle squared plus pi squared squared. Okay? Any questions on just that setup? I'm going to play with it now. Okay. So that's the setup. Let me do a calculation in this because I want to show you that the effect of Lagrangian gives you the same result eventually. So let's do, it's pi plus pi zero scattering. Okay, I won't do all the funny details, but I want to show you the crucial pieces. Basically, there's a diagram like that, which is, if I do this pi plus, pi zero, this is just equal to minus 2i lambda v, lambda, just minus 2i lambda, and you can just read that out of the, that term right there in the Lagrangian. Okay, we'll, little work counting factors of 2. There's another one which is sigma twiddle pi plus or pi zero going to pi plus or pi zero, and this is equal to minus 2i lambda v. Okay, and that can be read out of this term right there, sigma twiddle 2 pions, just factors of i, well, factors of 2. Okay, so those are simple. The scattering then is, I have this diagram and I have at the same order I'm going to have this diagram here. So this is the sigma twiddle, pi plus, pi zero, and this one is just the minus 2i lambda from there. This one here is minus 2i lambda v from what we did before, I over q squared minus m sigma twiddle squared, which is itself 2 lambda v squared from what we set up above there. 2 lambda m sigma squared is 2 lambda v squared. So when I put these together, skipping a step or two, I get minus 2i lambda. One is the first term from the contact interaction, and from the second term I get a factor of 2 lambda v squared over q squared minus 2 lambda v squared. And I've showed you all the factors that go into that. And at this stage, something funny happens. So that's that's not surprising, is that there is now a surprising cancellation. You see, as Q goes to zero, those two terms cancel. So it becomes I, in the end, it's Q squared over V squared. And if I tried expanding, it'd be 1 plus Q squared over 2 lambda V squared. That's the next term plus dot, dot, dot. So there's a cancellation. Okay. And is this a fluke? Is it an accident or not? Now, of course, I'm telling the story. Oh, geez, I put that in the wrong area. All right. I will clip that and move it down later. So the notes will actually have this one sitting down below this where it should be. I'll leave the space for it. But the point of this is that cancellation is not an accident. And it has something to do with the symmetry of the theory. The symmetry up here is hidden. The fact that it's renormalizable is obvious. The fact that it's symmetric, that this had some initial symmetry of rotating sigmas and pi's into each other, is totally hidden now after I've done symmetry breaking. And in fact, we'll come back to it. The name symmetry breaking seems to mean that there is no symmetry anymore, which isn't actually correct. But now I'm going to make a pathway to the effect of Lagrangian. So now I'm going to start forming the effect of Lagrangian. So the first step is actually just a notation change. I'm going to call sigma, capital sigma, is sigma plus I tau dot pi. And I'll say what all these things are. The tau are the Pauli matrices. The Pauli spin matrices, the 2x2 matrices. So this is a 2x2 matrix. The only things you need to know about those Pauli matrices is that they're traceless. And trace of two of them, tau I, tau j, equals 2 delta ij. So things that you clearly know. But if I then...
John?
Yes?
If the cancellation was as a result of, like, symmetry of rotating pi to sigma and things like that, shouldn't the cancellation occur for all q and not just for q equals 0?
Well, no, we'll see. The cancellation is of the constant terms. And so what happens when spontaneous symmetry breaking is the Goldstone bosons really have interactions that vanish at zero energy. That's where the symmetry is. So zero energy, if they don't carry any energy, then that's really a reflection of the original symmetry of the theory. It's not at all obvious here, but we'll see it in a few minutes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thanks.
Okay, so let's... The Lagrangian that I wrote before now can be written. So there's now no approximation here. I'm writing this as just a notation change, 1/4 trace d mu sigma plus mu squared over 4 trace trace sigma dagger sigma minus lambda over 16 trace sigma dagger, sigma quantity squared. Okay. Now, you can see that this works the same way because the trace of the one term here gives me a factor of two. I get the kinetic energy for that. And this is staggered. The off-diagonal piece vanishes. And then the trace of the two pi's give me delta ij. And I get back to the same old formula. In this language, the rotations of sigma into pi and pi into sigma it's visible that there's a symmetry. Sigma goes to some L sigma R, where this is a SU2 matrix, a unitary basically a unitary 2x2 matrix is really all I need to do. 2x2. And this is another one. Okay. So these, and you can see it, all these terms here, if I do this multiplication, the L's and the R's all cancel out and I have a symmetry. So the fancy phrase for this is the symmetry is SU2 left cross SU2 right. But for our purposes, I don't need to use the fancy language, but you can just do that. Okay, so that's no approximation. I'm going to do something now, it's also no approximation. I'm going to change names. So this is, again, one of these field redefinitions that I mentioned briefly before. We can do a field redefinition. And instead of sigma being given by I, sigma plus I tau dot pi, I'm going to write this instead in the following form. I'm going to call it V plus S times U. Okay. U, I'm going to take to be e to the I tau dot pi. I'll put a prime on it over V. And S is something else as a field. This is a change of names. And if you worked it out, you can work it out order by order. I'm sorry, and this here, remember, was V plus sigma twiddle. Get rid of that. The what we previously called sigma twiddle is S plus other stuff. What we've called pi here is pi prime plus other stuff. So they start out being the same fields at linear order and then are changed afterwards. Okay. But now the Lagrangian is actually quite different. L, it becomes V plus S squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger d mu u. Minus, okay. Now, u dagger u equals 1. So when I form sigma dagger, I see this all cancels out. And in the end, there's a little bit of algebra here. Lambda V S squared minus lambda over 4 S to the fourth And then there's a mass terms, there's 1/2 d mu s squared minus m sigma squared s squared. Okay. So this is, again, no approximation made here. Okay, this is after symmetry breaking.
But shouldn't there be a dot, dot, dot in the Lagrangian also? Because the
no, there's no dot, dot, dot in the Lagrangian.
So the old Lagrangian, we are just redefining.
The old Lagrangian, yes. So remember, the old Lagrangian without approximation was written in terms of sigma like this.
Yes.
I make that this sigma definition right here, and I get exactly this Lagrangian.
Oh, okay. I see.
The things that you may not see in doing well, the easiest ones are right here, sigma diagram sigger, the U's drop out, and it's only S's, V plus S. And so then I just do some algebra to get rid of those.
Okay.
The one that's a little less obvious is right there, but certainly if I only take the derivatives on the S field, then the U's cancel out. Mm-hmm. So you can easily get the fact that those guys are there. And then there's a little bit of work to get this last piece here, but it's just, that's what it is. It's the derivatives only act on the U. Okay? So there's no approximation here. The beauty of this is that the symmetry is obvious. Even after symmetry breaking. The symmetry here is S stays unchanged and U goes to L U R dagger. Okay, the same symmetry that sigma had is now all carried by U. But it's completely symmetric now, which seems a bit funny because you're supposed to say symmetry is broken, but it's really not. It's just hidden in the previous way. It's still there. There it is. But what's not so obvious is renormalizability. This is renormalizable. Renormalizability is hidden. So previously, renormalizability was obvious. Symmetry was hidden. Now it's just the reverse. Okay. So now let's look at this version of the theory. The feature that we can see something here that's interesting is that if I'm doing that same scattering amplitude, so let's do scattering. There's going to be a four. These last terms over here, the ones with only S's in it, don't give any scattering amplitudes. It's all in that first term. And there's one term that comes with no factors of S. So there is a piece that looks like this. And if you... I won't calculate it out, but... Let me just, for the moment, just call this of order e squared over v squared. Okay. You can see the factors of e because there's two derivatives there. So there's two derivatives. They turn into factors of energy, and they're distributed among the different pions. There's also a vertex that looks like this s pi. Pi, that follows from the linear term in S there. That's also of order E squared over V squared. So when I put these together, I'm now going to put these together scattering. I do this plus this. This first term is the order e squared over v squared. The second term is of order e to the fourth over v to the fourth. So we've now got something different than we had before. Previously, we had polynomial terms when we did this scattering, just ones and propagators. Now we get terms that are of different orders. And so I can, in fact, at low energies, I can drop this. And all I have to do is work this out. And I get q squared over v squared from there. Okay? So what I've done is just dropping the heavy particle gives the right answer. Okay. So if you're working to this order, we can reconstruct that physics from just v squared over 4 trace d mu u, d mu u dagger. Order. Okay. Now that's actually somewhat remarkable. This is true now. It'll be true for all processes. I've only demonstrated it for one particular one, but if you go through the old calculation, you can see that there'll be cancellations of increasing complexity using the original basis. They, in this second basis here, they're not that complex, they're not hidden at all because the symmetry is there. Let's see, where is that guy? Ah, there it is. And you can see here that all the pion stuff to two derivatives all comes out of just that with the leading piece. So at least at tree level, this works exactly. But by this change of variables, I can see that it was not an accident. It had to happen. It's a consequence of the symmetry that it's only derivative interactions at low energies. So this makes it exceptionally useful if you actually have to do some of these. If you calculate 2 pi to 8 pi, it's just a bunch of algebra using that, whereas it's a very painful calculation using the other one. Since I've done integrating out, if I do this here, this upper here vertex is trace d mu u. The lower vertex is that the propagator is there. We actually get, basically, this behaves like j of x. We get j of x propagator j of y goes into minus 1 over m squared, m sigma squared, jj, the local term. And so this ends up giving an effective Lagrangian at next order. So let me just write the answer, and then we'll move on the the effect of Lagrangian to the first two orders is v squared over 4 trace d mu u dagger plus it's v squared over 8 m sigma squared trace d mu u dagger squared. This reproduces the first two orders. In all scattering amplitudes. Now I realize I just realized that as saying that as I actually skipped something. So if you want to ask about this in this one here, I have given enough information to you to get that, but it may not be as obvious as I thought it was going to be at this stage, because I actually forget to say something earlier. Anyone want to ask about that part? This is really just an application of the integral that I, the free field integral here, where if I have the free field Lagrangian and some coupling to the linear coupling, I just get trace of J dj, which in this case, the what plays the role of J is actually this term linear in the Lagrangian. It was sitting right there. Linear in S and so if I can call that J. And come down here and I use it, I get the effect of Lagrangian. It looks like that.
So we've integrated out the S field.
I've integrated out the S.
And but even the Lagrangian before integrating out, you had written only U fields. Could you go a little up?
You gonna go up yet?
Yeah. That this yes. One also didn't have any S.
Right.
Which
so
I
in for, to get the leading piece, I can just totally drop S.
I see. Okay.
Because the S interactions are of order e squared, so if I have two of them, it's of order e to the fourth.
Perfect.
Okay?
Got it.
And so now I've just written out what that e to the fourth interaction is. I calculated it's just this term here, which is of order e to the fourth. I've got my e squared, my e to the fourth. I've got the first two leading orders. So I reproduce all the stuff before. But so this is now a step that's yet further. The symmetry is still obvious, but it's non-renormalizable. The previous version with the S there, it's renormalizable even if we can't see it. This one, since there's infinite powers of this pion field, is obviously non-renormalizable. In the bad phrasing of non-renormalizable, meaning I can't renormalize it using just the first term by itself. But it gives the same scattering amplitudes at low energies. Okay, so we've a little bit, this is a miracle. It's not at all obvious that this should happen, but we've done it now by direct construction, and you can check all the steps if you want. This is a version of this renaming theorem, Hogg's H-A-A-G theorem, which rather than write out that it's a formal theorem, I just say names don't count. Basically, you can do renaming, and yet you get the same scattering amplitudes. There is a little trick to it. It's if I do some renaming phi prime is some f of phi, where those are the fields in a theory. The one thing you do have to have happen is that this has to be phi plus dot, dot, dot. In other words, they have to coincide at linear order. And so that makes the kinetic energies the same. And that's important for the theorem. The other thing that's important for the theorem is this only works on shell. We saw that in the discussion of mu to e gamma, the amplitude didn't vanish. In general, it vanishes on shell. The same thing would happen here, though it's less obvious what happens here. So we're free to do this renaming at will, and we've taken advantage of it here to form a very simple effect of Lagrangian that calculates for us all the tree level amplitudes that we need to do to two orders. Okay. Any questions on this step? Okay, so my real goal here is loops. So tree level, in some ways, you can start seeing, even though this one was pretty non-trivial, that was very non-trivial. But now we want to make this a full quantum field theory. And to do that, we have to allow ourselves to do loop diagrams. And at first, I'm just going to do this with pictures. So it's going to be a cartoon version of a real calculation. And then I'll show you some of the details of the real calculation. So what we just did is we showed you that in the original theory, when I used sigma twiddle exchange, this equaled this in the effective theory. So I just, this being the trace u, d mu u dagger piece, the leading term. So at low energies, those two are equivalent. So let me imagine doing loops. If I want to do a certain set of loops, let's do, in the full theory, I would do this diagram, which is the product of those two. There's a cross term, which I'd like to write out, which is looks like. Oh, sorry. Let's get rid of that. It's so one vertex is the point vertex, the other is the exchange. There's another one, which is the exchange is on the other side. And then there's a box diagram. That's the full theory. The effective theory, we just have only one diagram. We have that diagram where this is L effective. So when doing loops, how am I guaranteed that the result from the full calculation, which after all is renormalizable, gives me the same result as the results from the second calculation? Okay, and the answer is that in general it doesn't give exactly the same results, but it gives results that are true in the low energy limit. And the logic is that those two vertices are equal by the first identification by star. In at low energies. But they're obviously going to be different at high energies. So low energies parts of those loops are the same, high energy parts are different. But the logic continues. High energy is local. So it looks like a term in an effective Lagrangian. And it can be whatever that effect is. It's clearly wrong. The effective field theory's high energy part is wrong. We don't trust it at all because it just is wrong by construction. But we know that it's local, and then it goes into some local terms, which then leaves the low energy stuff unchanged, plus there's some local effects left over. And so let me just see if I can show you how that works. In this case, I'm gonna try to do this by pulling formulas out of it.
What was star there when you wrote
star? Star. I wrote star up here as being this relation. Let's double star.
Oh, okay.
By star, double star. Okay. That relation there tells us that those are equal at low energies and not equal at high energies. Okay. So that leads us into this logic. All right. So let's see how adept I can be at pulling this off. Well, first I want to. I want to go back to. I want to go back to the full calculation. I don't know if you haven't done some of these calculations, you may not realize how tough that calculation is. In particular, the box diagram is a bear. So I just want to, just for fun, I'm not going to put this into the notes, but let's just show you the box diagram. Okay, so what I have here is a paper that calculates scalar box diagram that looks like that. It has no momentum factors in the numerator, so it's the easiest possible one. And the answer has this form. It has the Spence functions, the Dye logarithms. It has a bunch of obscure notation, which isn't immediately obvious, and it goes on for quite a long time. Okay? So you say, well, what is that? That's what the answer looks like. And so you scroll back in the paper, and you see a bunch of definitions for what these funny symbols are. And you start realizing that they're complex symbols there, pretty complicated. Here's some of the symbols, what they mean, Q bars are there. You can try writing out what each of the symbols mean. And you realize that formula has become a very complicated function. Then you get to the title, and this is the most compact expression that exists for the box diagram. Okay? So this isn't like it's an easy calculation. But if you do the calculation, you do it in general, you can take the low energy limit. And actually, if you don't mind me, I'm going to do the clipping later just to make your notes look good. But here I won't, because I'm really just going to clip and move it from one to the other. Okay, so if you excuse me. if you do the calculation with a full box diagram and everything and take the low energy limit, this is a calculation that Gasser and Leutwiler did. It's actually surprising it took till the 80s to do it. That's what the full answer is. Okay, if I do it in the effective theory, I have to show you one thing, which I was going to show you. Let me postpone that for a minute. There's going to be two effective Lagrangians to the next order in general. And the calculation that I get in the effective theory, anybody can do in their sleep, because it's just a bubble diagram. You can write out this answer in 25 minutes or so. It's something very simple, and it has that form. Those two amplitudes correspond up to these terms, which I haven't yet showed you, and divergences had occurred, but they can be absorbed into these two parameters, L1 and L2. So there's two parameters that are going to be here. There'll be divergences that are completely spurious. They don't exist in the full theory, because you can see the result there. But everything else matches. And so if you just match the theories with a particular choice of these variables, you get exactly the same scattering amplitudes at low energies. Okay? So let's go back and fill in one step or so. I'm sorry?
The external momentum, right? That's what you mean. You take the external legs to be small.
You take the external momentum to be small, exactly.
But the loop diagram, isn't it divergent? Isn't it log divergent?
So in both, actually, in both the full theory and the effective theory, there are divergences. In the one case, you just renormalize lambda and mu squared, the parameters of the original Lagrangian. It's a renormalizable field theory, and you just have to renormalize those guys.
Yeah, that's fine. But if the diagram is divergent, that means that there's arbitrarily high momentum going inside the loop.
Right.
So how?
That's right. Yes.
Why will the two calculations match?
Okay, so I will answer that by going back over some of the things.
In other words, don't the momentum inside the loop blow up the vertex of the effective Lagrangian?
Yes. Because so let me actually do one thing before we do that, because I want to show you the terms in the effective Lagrangian for where the divergences hide. Then we'll come back and answer your question again. Okay? If I was doing the clipping and showing you how to do the calculation in detail, I would note that I'm supposed to write out this energy expansion with a general Lagrangian, and we haven't quite written that out yet. So the Lagrangian here is v squared over 4 trace d mu u d mu u dagger, and there's two terms of the next order. I showed you tree level, there's only one, is L1, we're calling it, trace d mu u, d mu u dagger squared. And there's L2, which is not the square of something, it's d mu u, d nu u dagger times trace d mu d nu u dagger. Okay, so these are the only two possible ones at the next order that are consistent with the symmetry. Okay, So now let's go back and answer your question. First, at the cartoon level, what you're saying, and what is totally true, is that this effective theory, the one I'm doing that diagram there, the high energy parts of that are going to be just wrong. There's no doubt about it. So if I see you wonder, meaning the high energy parts of the loop, I've got the external momentum though still stuck at low energies. So actually that's actually right here what I should have said. At low energies in the loop, they differ at high energies in the loop. But I'm keeping such external momentum. So I keep the external momentum low, but in the loop there's high momentum flowing around. And so your question was the spurious divergent, why doesn't that kill anything? And the point is, then the next line is that the high energy loop stuff is local because of the uncertainty principle. So this is again the uncertainty principle or Applequist-Carrier zone or whatever, however you want to phrase it. So it looks like a local term in an effective action. And since I've written out my most general effective action, that high energy stuff, the divergences, go into terms that are local in the effective action. Okay, so let's go back now to the calculation, and see how that actually worked out. The part that I can now show you is that the high energy divergences they carry the same external momentum dependence as these L1 and L2s, that they have to. They look like they come from local Lagrangians. And so by defining renormalized parameters like that, I absorb all divergences. And leftover effects expressed in terms of those two parameters are exactly the same in the two amplitudes. Okay, it's not trivial, but that's the logic of the effective field theory. Does that answer your question? Okay, good.
John, also the prefactors don't match, right?
They should match. Let's go back. Yeah, they do match. I mean the various numbers here. This one has m sigma squared v squared, which if you recognize it, that was the tree level answer. That mm-hmm. if I just from doing exchange, but I then identify these parameters this particular way. If I make that matching, then I get the exact same answers.
I see. So. Means the two expressions. I was just thinking the numbers like 576, 144, these things don't exactly match.
Yeah, right, but they go into this identification right there. So there's a 35 over 6 and 11.
I see.
So the basic point is that the physics matches mm-hmm. if you make this identification. So this ends up showing us that some of our basic principles here. We've gotten locality again. We've got the energy expansion. And we've gotten matching. But now we've done it at full loop level. And and we're now in the game. You can continue this. Basically, there is one thing that I haven't explained, but which is now perhaps obvious. There's a power counting theorem. Which is that at tree level, the results are of order energy squared at one loop. It's energy to the fourth. We saw that from these guys here or from this explicit amplitude, which I won't go back to, but it was, it had two powers of energy at two loops. It's energy to the sixth, et cetera. So the loop expansion also ties into the energy expansion. This often goes by the name of Weinberg. It's easy, but time-consuming to show. But it basically, you can see it by dimensional analysis. One loop. These diagrams here. There's a 1 over v squared here, 1 over v squared there. So the answer, which is dimensionless, has to be e to the fourth over v to the fourth at two loops. Let's see if I can draw that. Yeah, good. It's 1 over v to the sixth, because there's a 1 over v at each vertex, so it has to be e to the sixth. So basically, fancy power counting theorem is really just dimensional analysis. Okay. Any questions there? So what I'm doing at this stage is my EFT 2.0 full quantum field theory. Okay, that's basically where I'll stop on that part. My next things are about techniques to use in this, like background field method and the like. So this is a good place to stop for some questions, but I don't want to stop the lecture here. Any questions at this stage? We've developed the theory, we've constructed non-trivial, non-renormalizable effective Lagrangians, and we've made loop calculations using non-renormalizable theories, had we renormalized them.
So John, we did all this for the linear sigma model only, right?
Right.
So why had you mentioned non-linear sigma model for maybe something we'll do next, or?
So, I'm sorry.
So you had mentioned nonlinear sigma model for something that we'll do next, or?
Oh, the nonlinear sigma model is the effect of Lagrangian there. Okay. So maybe I should just stop and say that also. The nonlinear sigma model is often said to be when sigma squared plus pi squared equals, in this case it's v squared, it's that constant. And that the effect of Lagrangian for that is a constrained theory, which is this v squared over 4 trace d mu u. Dagger. So that is the nonlinear sigma model. Okay, I should have said that. Thank you.
So we start with the linear sigma model, we integrate out stuff, and we arrive at the nonlinear sigma model.
Right.
Okay.
And basically, you can sort of see it from what we did. Sigma was Yeah, that's actually, let's not go there. But yes, you've integrated out the sigma. It's basically, or we've basically dropped the sigma in a way. And I have a nonlinear model that comes out that has the same symmetries as the sigma model. And so this is another representation of the nonlinear sigma model. There are others. If you go to the Dynamics of the Standard Model book, when I do this and that, of course, obviously. If you go there, you'll see another representation which is much closer to the nonlinear sigma model representation that you may be more familiar with. And you can do the same thing. You calculate the amplitudes and show that it's representation independent. But here I didn't want to do the third way. I just wanted to do the ones I needed to do. Okay. Next thing I'd like to do is the background field method. And let's see if I can speed up without becoming incomprehensible in this case so that I can finish something useful today. The first thing I'd like to do in this is, basically the point is that you can do some of these calculations in the presence of non-constant fields. Whether they're the portions of the same field or different fields, right now I'll do the case where I'm going to do QED again. So basically the same old calculation that we started with, but now I'm going to do it using a background field method calculation. And so the starting point that I'm interested in is I'm going to take a particle. It can be massive or massless. Many of my formulas here are m equals to zero along the way. But the final answer actually turns out to be true. Independent of it, just there's a bunch of steps that I can skip if I do this way. If I take the action to be, I'm going to do a scalar field. And d mu plus IE a mu is the covariant derivatives there. So my goal here is to do the path integral over phi of e to the I L, well, S, e to the I S for this particular scalar. And you know that's going to be a function of the A field. So I'm integrating out this scalar, though, again, I'll make it massive at the end. We're left then with something that's a function of the A field, which will be e to the I integral d4 x some L effective, like we had before. Okay, and I'm going to do this using this fancy path integral notation. This, by that definition, which I didn't prove for you, is e. Well, all right, let's take a break. The action there, the Lagrangian d mu phi, can be integrated by parts and goes to phi, let me script d phi, where this is d mu. Okay, so the script D is actually square of the covariant derivative. Or I can just leave it as D squared. The path integral formula that we started with tells me that the integral d phi e to the I phi script d phi equals e to the I trace log d. Okay, so this is one of these scary formulas. The trace here, there's no external indices, so it's really just the integral d4x itself. You sum over all possible space-time points, and then I have log d. So this is integral e to the I, integral d4x log, well, x log d x. That's the trace part. Okay, so at this stage, I can write d, well, d is the derivative squared plus two I a mu d mu plus I d mu a mu, where that's acting just on the a minus a squared, and there's factors of e floating around.
Okay. So, and John, when we do integration by parts, it should get a minus sign, and there should be an overall minus.
Yeah, I stuck it in there. I stuck it in real quick. There it is. Did you see me? You didn't see me do it.
Yeah, but during the calculation, we didn't put that there. That's
log of the minus sign, let's just factor out. In practice, those factors make a little difference for unitarity, and you have to put your I epsilons in the right place. But for us today,
the minus sign will not affect the log in any way.
No.
Okay.
You can, in the determinant, you can just factor out the determinant of minus one to the infinity powers of a number. Okay, so this tells me that if I write this as d squared plus some potential v of a, if I take log d, which is what I'm trying to do, I get log d squared 1 plus 1 over v, no, 1 over d squared v. This is all inside the log at this stage. And then I use the properties of the log as, this is log derivative, no interactions, plus the log of the second piece, which is then 1 over box v plus 1 over box v, 1 over box v plus dot, dot, dot. Or half there. Minus sign. Okay. This first term has no dependence on the field A. So this is a constant which I'm going to drop. And I have to calculate the following pieces there. These pieces, what do they mean? Well, 1 over box V from x to x 1 over box is the, if box Feynman propagator is that 1 over box is the Feynman propagator. Mm-hmm. So this is the Feynman propagator of x to x times v at x. And this is the diagram that you calculate like that. So there's factors of A on the outside here. They're contained there, but they're explicitly there in the effective action. If I have x 1 over box v, 1 over box v, x, this is d f x minus y v of y d f of y minus x v of x. So I've basically put a complete set of x minus of y's in here. This is the diagram that looks like that. You get a interaction V. You get a propagator and an interaction V. For massless fields, the first one disappears. This is equal to zero for massless fields. And in dimensional irregularization, there's no, it. So let's, and that's the simplification that I didn't want to have to carry that guy around. And you then just work on it. This turns into work. And I won't show you the work, but it's just partial integration at various places because my interactions had derivatives in it. So I'm just basically integrating by parts at various places. I get the residual interaction there's a minus sign I in front. It's integral d4 x d4 y f mu nu at x. It's the Feynman propagator now divided by 4 d minus 1. Actually, so let's make those d. All right. So what I've done is I've taken this field, and this was the propagator squared because one was x minus y and the other is y minus x. I've taken the propagator's squared term that was formally looks like this term in the expansion of log d, and I've turned it into something that looks like an expression that's just a general Feynman diagram without doing the Feynman diagram at this stage. But this then gives me the 1 over epsilon piece, if I calculate that, plus it gives me either this is the q squared over 5 m squared or a log, depending on whether the mass is zero or big, that I got before. So this is the QED calculation that we did before by Feynman diagrams. And I've now done it by doing the path integral in what amounts to the background field approximation or background field method. I've done the integral over the field in the presence of a background A field. Again, I had hoped to get a little further, but that's where I'm getting. So I'm going to stop here. next time I will start with the background field method for a single field. And I'll plot out what else I can do after from that for the time that I have in that portion of the lecture. In the case of a single field, we're going to take phi as the phi background plus some quantum field. We're going to integrate over this guy. And then I'll show you how you can apply this.
Just to summarize the background field method, we introduce a background field coupled to the gauge field, and then we integrate it out.
We integrate it out one of the fields. In the second case, what I'm going to do next time, maybe I'll just start with the nonlinear signal model and renormalize it by using background field method. We will take just a single field like phi, expand around the background, integrate out the correction, and you'll be left over with an effective Lagrangian that includes quantum effects from one loop.
I see.
Okay. And so by doing this, let's say in the nonlinear signal model that I've developed, I'll get the same perturbative expansion that I got before. But in fact, I'll get that same expansion for all possible matrix elements. It will be all contained in one formula. And the renormalization will be there, all in one formula. Okay, so that's what I'd like to do next. And then I have to figure out what I can squeeze in the rest of the day. Okay, good. And so I'll see you next time.
Just one quick question about this action that you wrote now,
yes,
is bilocal.
That's right. This one was, okay, so the delta function here, the propagator squared, really the divergence is local. And so it's delta 4 of x minus y times 1 over epsilon. And then q squared, by our locality arguments, turns into the derivatives of delta functions. So for massive fields, that becomes local. Okay, maybe I need to show that a little bit too. Okay.
If I'm integrating,
that's not as obvious as I think it is, because I've done this calculation a lot of times. The log piece is not local. That's the non-local piece that I showed you on
we discussed yesterday.
That was truly non-local. And this is another way of deriving that truly non-local piece.
If you integrate out a massless field,
integrating
this
out
is longer.
A massless field, you get a non-local piece. Integrating out massive fields, you get a local divergence and a non-local residual. Okay.
Yeah.